Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. In Uptown Dallas, there's an enormous glass and limestone building with carved eagles on the side. You've probably driven by it, but perhaps never known its story. The Federal Bank of Dallas is one of a dozen regional reserve banks that make up the nation's central bank. Now, before you start to yawn, listen to this. Some economists say the Fed has saved the economy. Saved your money, mine, everyone's. Not just once, but multiple times. Others say it should be abolished altogether. The debate actually goes back more than a century. Financial writer Roger Lowenstein has written a book about the birth of the Fed. It's called America's Bank: The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. Roger Lowenstein, welcome to Think.
Lauren, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Great. So before we travel back to the chaos you describe in the early 1900s, explain quickly what the Fed does today.
Well, Lauren, just like regular people need to go to banks either to borrow money when they're short, or maybe they have extra money so they want someplace to put it, the Federal Reserve is the bank to other banks. Banks themselves have excess reserves, and they park those in this system of reserve banks, the Federal Reserve banks around the country. And banks at times also need money, and they can borrow from the Federal Reserve, and they can particularly borrow in times of crisis, such as we saw to dramatic effect in the mortgage crisis in 2008. So that's one role, and obviously the Fed also sets short-term interest rates, and as you alluded to at the top of the show, that's those rates that we pay in car loans and mortgages and so on, all one way or another derived from the actions that the Fed takes on short-term interest rates.
Okay, we'll touch a little bit more on what it does today and how those powers have changed, but it definitely affects all of us directly and indirectly. Originally, though, what was the idea for a central bank in America?
Well, if you mean originally, we could go back to the very beginning of the Republic. Alexander Hamilton wanted a central bank to organize the nation's finances, help pay off the government's debt, the debts of the states, actually, coming out of the Revolutionary War, and to act as what's known as a lender of last resort, so that when ordinary banks lack credit, the government bank could lend them money and prevent a crisis. And Hamilton started a bank with George Washington's approval. It was abolished because people in this country, many of them, were very afraid of a central bank, that it would have too much power and maybe align itself with Wall Street against people in the interior of the country and so on. And that actually happened twice in the very beginnings of this country. It happened again in the 1830s. And if you want to go back to the origins of the Federal Reserve Bank that we have now, that was in the first decade of the 20th century. And we had in 1907, just about 100 years before the recent mortgage crash, a terrible banking panic. And banks, one after the other, shut down. They ran out of cash. Some of them invented scrip like Monopoly money because they just didn't have any real money left. People were, clamoring at their doors to withdraw money. And many people thought that we needed somebody to come in situations like this and say, okay, nobody else is lending. We, the central bank, are going to lend. And that's what propelled the movement to create the Federal Reserve.
So at the time, you were talking about the early part of the 20th century, what system of banking did countries in Europe have, where I'm sure many of the people who were in America had come from?
That's right. So all of the developed nations, the industrialized nations of the world in the early 1900s, already had a central bank. And their central banks actually worked pretty well. Their ordinary banks were confident that when they got in a pinch, they could borrow from the central bank, and therefore they were able to lend the reserves that they had, the credit they had, out freely into their economy. The U.S. was really just about alone in the industrialized world for not having a central bank.
And so what was the fear? Where did the fear come from then here that said, no, we don't want to venture into this idea of centralized power with a bank?
Well, Lauren, we rebelled against an English king, right? That's our history. And that still has, I think, a very profound effect on American politics. It obviously is the, look at the Tea Party, which, not only gets its name from the Boston Tea Party against the British, but has a very strong anti-central government ethos to this day. And many people follow it or share it to some extent. The the combination of strong federal agencies, which has always worried that stripe of American political thinking, combined with the idea of a federal bank where you'd not only give the federal government power but give it power over the economy, has always been very frightening to people, many people in this country, particularly as you get away from the part of the country where I'm in, the Northeast, you know, away from Wall Street, away from Washington, and closer to the part of the country where you're in, to, you know, the Midwest and the Southwest and so on.
Very much so. So you outline in the book a series of crises that led to the birth of the idea for the Federal Reserve System. But perhaps the worst was the Panic of 1907. What happened there?
Well, just as in 2008, when we had this mortgage crisis here that went from bank to bank, people may remember in 2008, it didn't start with big banks that everyone had heard of. It started with a couple of hedge funds. It started with some off-balance sheet vehicles that I won't even try to explain. But it started with the riskiest parts of the system and then went inward to basic banks, and pretty soon every bank in the country was getting a bailout, more or less. Same thing happened in 1907. It started with entities known as trusts, which were lesser regulated forms of banks. People became concerned that they were risky and they wouldn't be able to get their money back. There were bank runs, and I mean literal bank runs, not things, you know, today bank runs are things that happen on a computer screen. But in that era, people ran to the door. They many of them had satchels with them to take their cash home. You could see the desperation in their faces because they knew that if the bank ran out before it was their turn, you know, there went their savings. And this sort of panic went from bank to bank, first in New York, and then from city to city across the country into Texas and you know, elsewhere in the West and the Southwest. Banks, as I said, resorted to passing around scrip, just sort of monopoly money and
pieces of paper
and. Because these pieces of paper weren't an accepted national currency, they might be accepted in the given town. So a bank in Dallas might give an employer scrip, and that might be good for the employer to pay his workers with, and those workers could use it in a local store, but not in the next-door town. So, for instance, people in New York during this panic, which lasted for months, people in New York, they might have this scrip. They could not cancel a debt in Philadelphia, for instance, or in Boston or in Wilmington. A terrific illustration of the balkanization of the American financial system and how we lacked for some centralizing system so that money would be fungible and acceptable everywhere.
Interesting, the balkanization of the monetary system. I like that. Who saved the economy if there's these bank runs going on? Who came in and saved everyone?
So nobody fully saved it, but someone did do his best. And that someone was a fellow named J.P. Morgan, who was, of course, the most eminent financier in the United States. And what he did was he gathered together a couple of other top bankers, and they started going over the books of banks that were in trouble. And just like Ben Bernanke at the Fed a century later, they tried to analyze, well, you know, this bank's in pretty good shape. It just has a little liquidity problem, so we're going to organize a loan to it. But on the other hand, this one over here, it's really insolvent. No point putting more money into this one. We're going to let it go broke. And so they really played, and J.P. Morgan in particular, played central banker to the best of his ability.
Now, at the time, I read that J.P. Morgan was 70 years old.
That's right. So although he was his actions, I think you'd have to say, were heroic during the crisis, and they certainly mitigated or minimized or reduced the impact. Some people at least realized, gee, we're virtually the biggest economy in the world. We're an industrialized nation. We have, you know, steel mills, railroads, the whole bit. And we're relying for the solvency of our economy on one 70-year-old man. Don't you think it's time that we had a slightly more systemic or systematic approach?
That would be a scary thought. So who came up with an idea to expand power beyond just J.P. Morgan?
Well, the intellectual father, you know, the person who really had the idea, since that's what you asked about, and had been stalking this horse for a while, a fellow named Paul Warburg, who was a German emigre, came from a German banking family, and emigrated to the United States in 1902. By virtue of the fact that he married the daughter of an American banking family, a woman named Nina Loeb. And he settled in New York. And remember, we said that in Germany and other European countries, they all had central banks. And he immediately recognized that things were very different in the United States. Whereas in Europe, the central bank in each country in Europe, the central bank held the reserves, the excess credit of the country. In the U.S., each bank held its own reserve. And whenever there was any sort of a crisis, because each bank was afraid that it would go under, it tightened up and stopped lending. And, of course, this would exacerbate the general problem. And in fact, every fall when cash was needed in the countryside to harvest the crops, there was no one. Cash would drain out of the cities. There was no one to lend to banks in the cities. And interest rates would go up to 100% in New York. And Warburg saw this, and he just couldn't believe that in such an otherwise sophisticated and advanced nation as the United States, the banking system was so primitive. He likened it to a town that lacked a central reservoir and in which everyone maybe had a pail of water in the backyard. It just wouldn't really pay for fighting fires.
Interesting, though, that this immigrant from Hamburg, Paul Warburg, that he didn't reject the idea of his home country. I know many people who come to a new country, they're not happy with the conditions that they had before. It seems like he was trying to make America more European, more German-like in terms of the finance system.
Yes, Warburg was a very refined, cultivated, affluent gentleman. You know, unlike the typical immigrant that perhaps you're referring to, he didn't come because he was
wasn't
in a bad
needy,
way.
Or yeah.
He was not, you know, he was anything but poverty-stricken. Mm. He came, in fact, when he first married Nina, she wanted to live in New York. He wanted them to settle in Hamburg. At first, they did settle in Germany, but her homesickness got the better of her. She prevailed on him. So he came to the United States somewhat reluctantly, and I think was still a German in his heart. But he became so embroiled in the battle for monetary reform that Warburg actually changed his citizenship and became an American.
Because he wanted to vote?
I think because he wanted less to vote, he wanted to have influence. He wanted standing. He would write in his memoirs that his hope was that the Federal Reserve would come to be seen as one of America's great monuments, like the old cathedrals of Europe. He really came to feel very passionately about this reform, and he knew that to have influence, you know, he would have to give up the old country and become an American lock, stock, and barrel.
Well, there's a whole cast of characters behind the creation of the Fed. And when we come back, we'll talk about them. You outline in the book a German banker, a Virginia newspaperman, a Rhode Island senator, Woodrow Wilson. So coming up, we'll talk about those men and how a duck hunt helped create the Federal Reserve System. So you're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in for Chris Boyd, and we're talking about the Federal Reserve System. Maybe you've seen the Federal Reserve Bank here in Dallas, but you don't know how it connects to the larger central bank. We're telling that story today with author Roger Lowenstein. He'll be in Dallas at the Fed, of course, to give a lecture on December 16th. And you can find more and register at dallasfed.org. We'll also be back in just a minute after a break to talk about his book, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve, America's Bank.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. You can join our conversation. We're talking about the birth of the Federal Reserve by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. We left off, I'm speaking with Roger Lowenstein, and we left off talking about Senator Nelson, we left off talking about the birth of the idea with a German immigrant named Warburg. Who did he need to convince to set up the Federal Reserve System?
Well, he needed to convince somebody who was in power, obviously. He needed to convince somebody in Congress, and the reigning power in the U.S. Congress in that era was a senator named Nelson Aldrich, who was the senior senator from Rhode Island, a Republican, an extremely powerful senator. In fact, the newspapers referred to him colloquially as the general manager of the United States. Not the general manager of the Senate, the general manager of the United States. Aldrich was a sort of Lyndon Johnson-like powers in terms of moving the Senate to go where he wanted it to go. And he was, for a very long time, very conservative, resistant to any sort of change with regard to the financial system. But when the panic of 1907 happened, he had a change of heart.
So how did that occur? How did he switch positions?
Well, in a number of ways, Aldrich began to wonder after the panic if something had gone wrong. He began to make inquiries on Wall Street, and he ended up at the office of Kuhn Loeb, which was the investment bank where Paul Warburg worked. He was actually visiting another man named Jacob Schiff, also a very powerful financier. But Schiff realized that Aldrich should be talking to Warburg. So he walked him down the hall, and no sooner did Aldrich enter Warburg's office than Warburg let loose with a torrent of this uncapped passion that he had for the idea of central banking reform. Aldrich ducked out, I think, to probably just to get out of there. He said to Warburg that he should feel free to send him material. And the very next day, Warburg sends
classic
him a plan.
Get out of the situation,
yes,
response.
But Warburg, the very next day, sends him a plan for a central bank. He begins to follow it up. Aldrich doesn't respond, but he begins to think about what Warburg has been telling him, the material he's sending. And the next summer, he leads an expedition to Europe. Now, in this day and age, when Congress people go to Europe, they jet over, they have a couple of meetings, you know, they check their email on the flight back, and in 36 hours, they're home. Aldrich went for a couple of months. They went to Paris, they went to London, they went to Berlin, they went to all of the banking centers of Europe to investigate how Europe handled these crises, that, like the one America just had. And in every capital, they heard the same thing, which was, we don't have these kind of crises because we have a central bank that comes in to thwart them. And when he came back to America, Aldrich was a changed man.
Wow. So a transformation abroad. And Aldrich then goes and he invites a group of people on a secret mission, you write in the book. What's going on here?
That's right, Lauren. This is the point in the story where it sounds like the script has been hijacked by Hollywood scriptwriters, but it's really not. This really happened. So Aldrich comes back from Europe. He's now convinced that Warburg was right. He tells him, I think you're right. We can have a central bank. And for about 2 years, he does nothing. He's just afraid to put it on paper. The idea is so unpopular. As we said earlier in the show, people don't want a big new federal agency directing their finances. But finally, Aldrich realizes he's got to move. He needs the help of bankers, people who understand banks, to help him write the bill. But he feels he can't do it out in the open, or people would renounce it on the spot. So he invites Warburg and two other leading Wall Street bankers. I mean, the three of them really represent the cream of Wall Street, to help him draft it. But not in Washington, D.C., not in Rhode Island, where Aldrich is from. But he invites them to meet him on his private rail car. Aldrich is himself a very wealthy man. The rail car takes them down to the Georgia Palmetto Groves, way in the southeast. They're disguised as duck hunters. Paul Warburg actually brings along a hunting rifle. I'm quite certain he had no idea which was the front end of the rifle and which was the back end, but that was the disguise. When they get to the end of the train ride, they take a launch over to an island, Jekyll Island, where the same J.P. Morgan we mentioned earlier is a member of an exclusive club, a hunting club. And Morgan has for this week emptied out the club so there's no one there but staff. And over a week, in complete secrecy, their spouses don't know it, their associates at work don't know it, nobody knows it, they draft what will become the first draft of the Federal Reserve Act.
No GPS on their cell phones or anything to sort of pin them
down. No cell phones, not even telegrams. They are completely out. The staff is stuffing them with fresh turkey, freshly scalloped oysters, all sorts of delicacies. They're working around the clock. At night they're sitting around the table after dinner with aperitifs, going over their labors of the day. Warburg and Aldrich actually get into some blows about the details of this. Warburg feels very passionately that he knows the best way to organize this. Aldrich is also very strong-willed. But at the end of a week, they have a rough draft.
So really actually sort of hunting and seeing who's going to take each other down in the plan. What did they ultimately come up with? What was in the Aldrich plan?
The Aldrich plan was sort of a prototype of the Federal Reserve today. Like the Federal Reserve system today, with 12 banks around the country, it had, in this case, 15 units around the country. But it was more centralized so that the power was clearly held in the center, that is to say, in Washington. And the other big difference, and remember, this is a plan drawn up by bankers, was that the people who would run this system wouldn't be presidential appointees, as is the case with the Federal Reserve. President Obama named Janet Yellen and so on. President Bush named Ben Bernanke. But the leadership under the Aldrich plan would be bankers chosen by bankers. So this was going to be a sort of an industry self-regulating mechanism. Aldrich was, as I said, a very conservative senator. He still didn't truck with the idea of government regulation. And he thought, well, the banking industry had a problem. It should now take care of itself. But that was no reason for the public to be involved.
So after they finished this pretend duck hunt and came back, how did they present this plan, this idea, to the American public, who you said was understandably ambivalent about centralized power and banking?
Well, Aldrich sort of sent it over to the something called the Monetary Commission. The Congress had created a National Monetary Commission of other Congress people. Aldrich was the chair of it. He made it seem as if this was something drawn up by the Monetary Commission, not Aldrich himself, because Aldrich was known to be so conservative. Paul Warburg was also rather a very clever lobbyist. He created what he called the Citizens League to get behind this bill and make it seem as if there was grassroots supports for a central bank all over the country, ordinary people, small businesses, and so on. None of this fooled anybody. It got to the Congress and absolutely died. This is in 1912. And I should say that the Congress was undergoing a very rapid transformation. This was 1912, the progressive era. The conservative Republicans had really ruled the roost for several decades. But things were changing. People were talking about the power of Wall Street. They were talking about inequality. They were talking about financial crises. They were talking about the need for direct elections of senators. Aldrich and other senators were chosen by the legislatures. They were talking about things like limiting campaign contributions, very much like an era today. It was a time of technological change, and people were worried about who was controlling the strings, who was pulling the strings. And the conservative Congress that Aldrich had once led was changing before his eyes, and his bill, therefore, was really dead in the water, dead on arrival.
Where was opposition to the proposal of this idea the strongest throughout the country, not within Congress, but in which parts, which regions?
The further you got from New York and the further you got from Washington, the strongest the opposition was. Paul Warburg said that Americans had an abhorrence of power, and I think that was well put. And, the two locuses of power were really Washington, which was governmental power, and New York, which was obviously financial power. A central bank represented the combination of the two, and you could just sort of draw lines. The further you got in the South, in farming districts where they felt they had different interests, and obviously in the cities, in the West, in the Southwest, people were very, very afraid of this new construct, this new idea.
And you write in the book that Representative Charles, I think it was Lindbergh Sr., launched this investigation into Wall Street, and he represented a district that a century later would elect Tea Party activist Michelle Bachmann.
That's right. Charles Lindbergh Sr., of course, the father of the aviator, and I think it's not a coincidence that his constituents would later be the constituents of Michelle Bachmann, because the concerns were similar. Both were very much afraid of centralizing power in Washington. Both wanted to keep Lindbergh wanted, in Bachmann's case, wants to keep power in the regions. Lindbergh felt that this new proposed Federal Reserve would suck up the financial strength of the country away from individual regions and locales and locate the financial power in Washington and New York. And he was a very avid opponent of the Federal Reserve.
Now, was there much opposition, I would assume, on the Democratic side since Aldrich was a Republican? He came up with the idea. Did the Democrats come up with some sort of counteroffer?
Yes, the political alignment was changing then, but just to set you back in that era, the Democrats were then the party of laissez-faire, the party of small government. The Democratic Party was really a Southern party. It was very much a party, of course, of Jim Crow and segregation, and for that reason didn't want the federal government power increasing. In fact, the Democratic Party put in its platform in 1912 that they were absolutely opposed to the Aldrich Plan and absolutely opposed to any sort of a central bank. And William Jennings Bryan, who was the most popular Democrat at the time, insisted that he would not back any candidate who didn't agree with him. And this presented a real problem for Woodrow Wilson, who very much wanted the Democratic nomination, but actually was in favor of a central bank. And Wilson was pushed and pushed and pushed. And finally, under pressure from Bryan, Wilson came out and repudiated the central bank idea, even in fact as he was planning to try and enact one.
So today he'd be a bit of a flip-flopper.
Well, you know, during this campaign, when he came out and said he was opposed to the idea of a central bank, a banker got hold of him and said, you know, Woodrow, what's going on here? And Wilson, and, you know, today we think of Wilson as an idealist, very often a sort of sad figure, the end of the World War I figure who couldn't get the country to rally behind the League of Nations and so on. But Wilson was a very canny politician. And when this banker said to Wilson, why are you suddenly coming out against a central bank? He said, you don't understand politics. It doesn't matter what I say. I first got to be elected.
Very, very astute commentary there.
Sort of reminds you of some of the debates we're seeing in this year, 2016.
Yeah. So how did Wilson then convince fellow Democrats who were opposed to a central bank to embrace it?
Wilson realized, as he put it to another supporter, that the Aldrich Plan was dead. However, he said he hoped to get 60, 70, 80% of the Aldrich Plan through, but under another name. After his election, Carter Glass, very much a Southern Democrat, a representative of Virginia, was the ranking power among the Democrats in the House Banking Committee. It was sort of obvious to everyone that we would need some banking bill. It just wasn't sure what would be in it. There'd just been so much tumult in the banking sector. And Glass drew up a bill. He was very much in his party's tradition, that is to say, the laissez-faire, anti-federalist, keep power local, all of that. And so the bill he drew up makes quite an interesting contrast with the Federal Reserve today, even though this was the first draft of the Federal Reserve Act, because Carter Glass called for not 12, but 20 reserve banks around the country. And his bill had no Federal Reserve board in Washington, no Federal Reserve system at all, just 20 different banks around the country, a perfectly, to use the word that we used before, balkanized system. So there'd be a little reserve bank in the Southwest, there'd be one in the Rocky Mountain states, probably a few in California and so on, but no federalization at all.
Now, in the bill that ultimately passed, who was supposed to run the Fed?
Well, you know, at the stage that I just mentioned, that Carter Glass had presented, these independent reserve banks would be on their own. But Woodrow Wilson was, you know, heard this presentation. He was very much a student of American history, of Alexander Hamilton in particular. And he said to Glass, you're far on the right track, but it needs a capstone, just a little word, a capstone. It sounds very innocent. But what Wilson meant by capstone was a Federal Reserve Board that would sit on top and supervise and organize and really control the entire system. And Glass was horrified, but you know, Wilson was president-elect, soon to be president. Glass was only a committee chair. And Wilson put this capstone into place as the Federal Reserve System. And to get to your question about who would run the Federal Reserve System, Glass was a very conservative reformer. And much like Aldrich, he put private bankers on the board. So in the original Glass bill, the Federal Reserve Board was going to be run by bankers, chosen by bankers, not by the government.
But today, that's sort of reversed.
That's right. So Wilson, as I said, to become president, had to please William Jennings Bryan. He repaid the debt by making Bryan his Secretary of State. And when Bryan, who was quite a populist, quite the advocate of the common man, saw this proposal for a bankers-run central bank, he said, it's got to be run by presidential appointees. And he threatened to quit the administration, which would have really torpedoed not just the Federal Reserve Act, but Wilson's entire first term. And Wilson gave in. He changed the bill so that, as with today, the appointees in the Federal Reserve Board are all chosen by the president. They're all public servants.
You're listening to Think on KERA. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Let us know what you think of the Federal Reserve System or its history. We'll be back with more after a short break. Our guest, author Roger Lowenstein, will be at the Federal Reserve in Dallas at the bank here on December 16th. And you can find out more and register for the event at dallasfed.org. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the modern history of the Federal Reserve and also touch a bit on what's happened in recent political debates where the Fed has come up as a hot topic particularly among Republican presidential candidates.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
What the Fed is doing now is it is a series of philosopher kings trying to guess what's happening with the economy. You look at the Fed, one of the reasons we had the financial crash is throughout the 2000s, we had loose money, we had an asset bubble, it drove up the price of real estate, drove up the price of commodities, and then in the third quarter of 2008, the Fed tightened the money and crashed those asset prices, which caused a cascading collapse. That's why I am supporting getting back to rules-based monetary system, not with a bunch of philosopher kings deciding, but
that's Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz at the fourth GOP primary debate earlier this month. You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about one of the most powerful institutions in the world, the Federal Reserve. The central bank system was born out of a series of financial crises more than a century ago. And it's a story Roger Lowenstein tells in his new book, America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. So there are obviously critics, Roger, economists, politicians, who have called for an end to the Fed. What would happen if the Fed didn't exist?
Well, that's one of the things I try to show in the book, that when we didn't have a Fed, before we had a Fed, we had a terrible chaos in the banking system. And we also had a financial system that really lagged behind those of the rest of the world. People who wanted to sell goods from the United States, for instance, say to Latin America or other places, they had to finance these trades in Europe or countries where there was a central banking sector. Just a lot of ways we were second-class financial citizens.
But this debate goes on and on. Do you think that it ebbs and flows, or it will continue to be this way?
Very much. I said at the end of the book, when the Federal Reserve is finally enacted 2 days before Christmas, 1913, that enactment marked less an ending than a truce. And I think the battle really has reached one of epic proportions now, a high. The tape you played, obviously, from Senator Cruz demonstrated that there are many others, Rand Paul, and there are quite a few people unhappy with the Federal Reserve today. What I think is interesting is that the criticism aimed at the Fed today isn't aimed at it because it failed to intervene as it was designed to do and rescue the system during a crisis. It's really being aimed at the Fed because it did intervene and did do exactly what it was supposed to do. In the 1970s, people may remember, older listeners remember, that people were very angry at the Federal Reserve because interest rates were very high, as they had to be then to address the inflation then. Today, curiously enough, people are very angry at the Federal Reserve because interest rates, they say, are too low, which isn't usually associated with hardship.
Interesting. You can call and join our conversation, 800-933-5372, or send an email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Bruce in Fort Worth.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I just want to make a quick comment. I think many people think that the Fed and government debt is the reason the economy is in shambles, and if we would just come back to a gold standard and indiscriminately cut spending, things would be fixed. But one argument I've heard is that in a state capitalist society, the Fed is needed to prevent large-scale bank runs, and if we had a different economic system that didn't rely so much on crony capitalism, there would be no need for a Fed. In addition, I understand that the government debt isn't as big a deal now compared to World War II, when the debt to GDP was over 100%. The bigger issue, in my opinion, is that most of the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few, whose financial decisions have a unproportional impact on everyday citizens to eke a living out. We have right now corporations with all-time high profits that have billions in cash reserves overseas, who would rather engage in M&A and stock buybacks instead of R&D. In addition, we have the government spends too much helping keep the status quo for these corporations, specifically in extraneous defense spending and subsidies, instead of investing, what I believe, in American citizens and their local economies.
Yeah,
so they aren't dependent on Wall Street.
Let's unpack that a little bit. Thank you for your call. I mean, there has been a lot of criticism of the Federal Reserve in terms of bailouts, and that relates to who gets bailed out and who is helped by this system.
Yeah, Bruce, that was quite a list of concerns and all worthy ones. I wanted to address a couple in particular. One is there's a widespread misconception that the debt of the government is held by the Federal Reserve. It's actually held by the Treasury, and that's the deficit, the federal deficit that you referred to. And you're quite right that the federal deficit today is normal by historic standards. It was very high right after the mortgage crash and when we had a deep recession. But the deficit today is not out of hand by any means. The other thing you noted was that many people want to bring back the gold standard. And the beginning section of the book, before the Fed is created, is about America under the gold standard. I just want to point out that under the gold standard, the average American was very unhappy. The gold standard worked very well for bankers out east. It worked very well for Wall Street. But farmers, farming communities were extremely unhappy. In fact, under the gold standard, we had 30 years in a row of falling prices for the reason that there wasn't enough money in circulation because we could only have as much money as there was gold. And if you think about a farmer who may have debt at a fixed price and he goes out and then sells his crops to repay that debt, if every year his crops fetch less and less money, he's going to have an awfully hard time repaying his debt. And we had that situation for 30 years running, which is why the gold standard was so controversial, particularly among ordinary Americans in the Plain States, in the Southwest, in farm communities.
And the way the powers, of course, of the Fed have shifted quite a bit over time, but also the way people use whether it's gold or money has shifted. Let's go to a comment, Alex, in Dallas.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Do you have a question? Oh, can you hear me, Alex?
Yes, I can. Yeah, my question was, you know, essentially, especially during, like, you know, the 1933, you know, Gold Reclamation Act, in that time, most people were using cash. We seem to be kind of, transforming into a system that is much more, you know, credit-based. How does the Federal Reserve sort of, you know, manage, you know, if a bank does, in fact, need to borrow money from the Fed, but it's completely based on credit, and the individuals who are using that bank are mostly using credit, how does the Federal Reserve exactly measure, you know, what interest rates are or what, you know, inflation would be if there's really no cash in circulation?
Interesting question.
Great. Well, thanks for the question. Yeah. You know, credit is really nothing new. I mean, after all, a checking account employs credit. Where, you know, when you write a check, you're paying something using the credit of your bank, which has the confidence in you to give you a checkbook and make that purchase. I think what's different today is the form of transmission is electronic. So, you know, instead of a check going from you to your bank and, you know, a vault of gold being transferred between one bank and another, or between a bank and the Federal Reserve
Bank. Which they used to have to physically do.
Which they usually physically did.
Yeah.
So much today is electronic. The point I would make is in any society that uses credit, and our system is based on credit, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with credit. Credit is the means by which assets are transferred from people who have surplus assets to people who can put them to productive use. If we didn't have credit, all the money would be in the vaults of the rich, lying there fallow. So credit within proportion is a good thing. But in any society based on credit, regardless of whether it's transmitted, you know, in a Wells Fargo truck, a Pony Express wagon, or electronically, there will be times when the people who extend credit get nervous and pull back. And those are the times when you need some central agency to come in and say, OK, I'm going to lend. Nobody else is lending. I'll do it.
And that's what the Fed does today.
That's what the Fed does today. That's what the Fed does today.
What other powers does the Federal Reserve have that people might not usually think of?
Well, you referred to one, Lauren, under exigent circumstances, extreme circumstances. It has the power to issue all sorts of loans that, you know, popularly denominated as bailouts. And you know, this was extremely unpopular, obviously, during 2008 because – you know, who is being bailed out? Big banks, actually small banks too, but all sorts of banks. And, you know, but on the other hand, people, individuals with mortgages were not getting bailed out. And, you know, this is obviously a reason why the Fed today is having to answer for its actions in the 2008 financial crisis. And one reason there are bills throughout Congress that would restrict its power to come to the rescue of the banking system were there another crisis. The argument of the Fed is that if the banks fail, it's really bad for the rest of us. And they're not basing this, you know, on guesswork because we saw it happen in the Great Depression. So the argument of Ben Bernanke then, and he you know, he'll say the same thing today, was we didn't want all the banks failing. We didn't want another Great Depression. So as much as I hated to do it, I did it.
And now the Fed today is run by a group of a pretty small group. I think there are 12 pretty much who sit on the board, right, of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, more or less. There are seven governors. So the governors are the people in Washington. That's Janet Yellen and six others. And they are appointed by the president. And then there are 12 reserve banks around the country. But at any one time, the presidents of five of those banks join the seven governors in something called the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee. So these 12, seven from Washington and five from various places around the country, they're the ones who get together and decide on monetary policy day in, day out, or month in, month out, and in particular what to do about interest rates.
Now, those are questions that they determine right now. We have a caller who from Plano we're going to turn to. Jeff, are you there, Jeff?
Yes, and I was wondering exactly on that last point. It's really kind of the architecture, I guess you could say, of the Fed. And I don't understand this well enough. Maybe it's the gold standard question, but doesn't it kind of seem strange that humans, I know this sounds weird, but human beings are making decisions when the market could be making, or whatever happened to the invisible hand the market could make the decisions on interest rates, not humans. It kind of smacks of the Soviet Union and the Central Planning Bureau, whatever it used to be called, setting markets and setting, you know, things like that. Is there something, does that seem strange to you, I guess, is what I would be asking.
What do you think, Roger?
Well, the Federal Reserve only sets one interest rate and markets set the rest. So the Federal Reserve actually sets the rate for overnight loans. And the way it does that, remember, the Federal Reserve is a bank. It really is a bank. So it can, if it wants to lower interest rates, it's, although we say it lowers and raises as if it was a dictator, what it really does is, if it wants to lower interest rates, it loans more money. And you know what happens when there's more of anything, its price goes down. So if there's more money in the system because the Fed is loaning more, the price of money goes down. If the Fed decides to loan less, there's less money in the system and its price goes up. But all of the other rates, that is to say the rate for 30-day bills, for six-month bills, for five-year treasury bonds and so on, notes, they're all based on a market rate. You know, bond traders, people worried about inflation, people who are making decisions about whether or not to lend to corporations, those are all market rates. You know, is it the Soviet Union? Our economy has done over so many decades so much better than the Soviet Union's ever did that somehow I don't think that categorization quite fits.
And now today, every major economy in the world has a federal bank, right?
That's true. Every economy has a central bank today.
But the powers are I'm assuming, a little bit different depending on which place we're talking about.
Well, they're you know, run differently. I would say they're more alike than they were 100 years ago. Lauren, actually, I want to add to something that you asked about. You were asking about what are the powers of whether it's, you know, other central banks or ours. But we haven't touched on one very important one where the Fed really fell down on. Several years ago, and that's the power as a regulator. So the Fed not only determines interest rates, but it sets the rules for what kind of loans banks can make, who they can loan to, what are the rules that govern all sorts of loans, including mortgage loans. And obviously, the Fed did not pay enough attention in the years leading up to the mortgage crash about who was getting mortgages, what sort of mortgages were being written, you know, what were the terms for qualifying, and so on. And that was a real miss on the Fed's watch.
So it's had its own mistakes as well, just like we talked about the invisible hand. These are humans, and they do sometimes make decisions that we would not agree with, or looking back, don't.
That's right. I said in the book that, you know, that the Federal Reserve was created with all the best intentions, but it would be up to each generation to put in place as wise or unwise a policy as it did. Obviously, the Act of 1913 couldn't alone guarantee a good monetary policy for the next 100 years.
Roger Lowenstein, thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be on the show.
Roger Lowenstein is the author of a new book, America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. He'll be in Dallas at the Fed to give a lecture on December 16th. You can find out more and register at dallasfed.org. Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Weddington. You can contact us via email, think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd, who will be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening and have a great day.